Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Après avoir procédé aux consultations prévues,
after having proceeded with the consultations as provided in Article 12 of our Constitution, I decided to give back to you the choice for the future of our Parliament with a vote. And so I am dissolving tonight our National Assembly.
President Emmanuel Macron dissolves the French Parliament, calls for snap elections following major gains in France and across Europe. We'll get the latest. Then, with nearly 85,000 people wounded in Gaza, its healthcare system is barely functioning after coming under direct attack by Israel. We'll speak with an emergency medical doctor who just left Gaza. And we'll be joined by Jewish-American Army Major Harrison Mann. He's the first military and intelligence officer to publicly resign over the Biden administration's support for Israel's war on Gaza.
I started my resignation in November because even then, in the first weeks of the war, it was really clear that the Israelis were prepared to inflict massive numbers of civilian casualties, that their conduct of the war, including the killing of civilians, was going to provoke a violent response.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Hamas has accepted a United Nations Security Council resolution calling for a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. The U.S.-supported resolution passed Monday on a vote of 14-0 after Russia abstained. Its passage came after the Biden administration vetoed three previous resolutions calling for a ceasefire. Palestinian ambassador to the United Nations, Riyad Mansour, called the resolution a step in the right direction and demanded a permanent ceasefire.
Our position has been always to have an immediate ceasefire to stop the killing of our people. So this resolution is a step in that direction. The proof is in the details, and we want to see that this resolution to be implemented beginning with the ceasefire, and that this ceasefire to be permanent. We do not want to see the continuation of the fighting.
In a statement, Hamas said it would accept the ceasefire resolution and was ready to work with mediators to engage in indirect negotiations with Israel. Top U.S. officials have said Israel would accept the plan, contradicting statements by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Meanwhile, there's been no let-up in Israel's assault. Following the resolution's passage, Israeli attacks have killed at least 11 people in northern and central Gaza. This all comes as world leaders and top aid officials are gathered in Jordan for an emergency humanitarian summit on Gaza. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas are attending the summit. Israel was reportedly not invited. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces raided the Al-Fara refugee camp Monday, killing at least three people, including a 15-year-old Palestinian teenager named Mahmoud al-Nabrisi. This is a resident of the Al-Fara camp.
They raided the house and damaged everything, and the house and the ceiling, everything. They ruined the washer and refrigerator, the bathroom, not leaving anything in it. They are terrorists and do not care for anyone.
Israeli forces have also arrested multiple children in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem in recent days. Since October 7th, Israel's killed over 530 Palestinians in the West Bank and arrested over 9,000. Here in the U.S., a federal court heard arguments Monday in an appeal to a lawsuit accusing top Biden administration officials of complicity in genocide. The case at the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals was brought by Palestinians and human rights groups, including Defense for Children International Palestine. The suit seeks to end U.S. military and diplomatic support for Israel during its assault on the Gaza Strip. It names as defendants President President Joe Biden, Secretary of State Antony Blinken, and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. Monday's oral arguments were presented by Katie Gallagher, a staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Your Honor, what this case presents is a clear allegation, a well-pled allegation of violations of binding law. The duty to prevent genocide and aiding and abetting genocide, those are clearly established in law.
In California, police arrested more than 20 peace activists Monday evening as they staged a protest at the campus of the University of California, Los Angeles. The violent arrest came after students held a funeral procession for the more than 37,000 Palestinians killed by Israel's assault. This comes just days ahead of UCLA's commencement, when scores of student protesters facing disciplinary hearings may be prohibited from joining graduation ceremonies, and just weeks after campus police and security officers refused to intervene as pro-Israel counter-protesters armed with sticks, metal rods, and fireworks attacked students at a Gaza peace encampment. A federal jury in Florida has ordered Chiquita Brands International to pay over $38 million in damages to the families of eight Colombian men who were killed by paramilitaries that the banana giant funded. Chiquita previously pleaded guilty to paying the far-right United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia paramilitary group, or AUC, $1.7 million from 2001 to 2004, which Chiquita argued it did to protect its workers. The AUC has been found responsible for committing mass human rights abuses and murdering civilians from 1997 to 2006. Earth Rights International, which helped represent the plaintiffs, said in a statement, quote, "This verdict sends a powerful message to corporations everywhere. Profiting from human rights abuses will not go unpunished. These families, victimized by armed groups and corporations, asserted their power and prevailed in the judicial process," they said. Belgium's prime minister has formally resigned following a surge Sunday when Belgian voters cast ballots in general, regional and European elections. The right-wing anti-immigrant New Flemish Alliance will lead negotiations to form a coalition government in Belgium. This came as part of a wave of gains by Eurosceptic and far-right parties in EU elections over the weekend. We'll have more on those elections and the rise of the far-right lines. Newly published audio reveals Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito questioning whether the United States can overcome its polarized political divide and appearing to endorse a Christian theocracy. Justice Alito made the comments at the annual dinner of the Supreme Court Historical Society June 3rd. The audio was secretly recorded by documentarian Lauren Windsor, who posed as a conservative activist. In the recording, Justice Alito agrees when Windsor says she hopes to, quote, return our country to a place of godliness. And Alito appears to rule out compromise between polarized political factions.
One side or the other is going to win. I don't know. I mean, there can be a way of living together peacefully, but it's difficult, you know, because there are differences on fundamental things that really can't be compromised. You know, really can't be compromised. So it's not like we're going to split the difference.
In a separate recording from the same event, Justice Alito's wife, Martha Ann Baumgartner, complains about rainbow flags during Pride Month, quotes at length from the Bible, assails feminists as feminazis, and boasts of her German heritage. In May, Justice Alito told Congress he will not recuse himself from cases involving Donald Trump and the January 6th Capitol insurrection after photos emerged of two flags associated with election deniers flying in front of his homes in Virginia and New Jersey. Donald Trump sat for a virtual interview Monday with a New York probation officer ahead of his July 11th sentencing for his conviction on 34 felony counts of conspiring to interfere with the 2016 election. In other Trump news, the presumptive Republican presidential nominee held an outdoor Las Vegas rally Sunday at temperatures soaring over 100 degrees in the desert city. Trump joked to his supporters they should not die before they're able to vote for him.
Nice. You feel the breeze? Because I don't want anybody going on me. We need every voter. I don't care about you. I just want your vote. I don't care.
Six rally goers had to be taken to a hospital. Another 24 received on-site medical attention due to the intense heat. Meanwhile, in Arizona, Rudy Giuliani was booked and posted a $10,000 bond in the Arizona criminal case involving the use of fake electors to overturn Trump's 2020 loss. Jury deliberations are underway in Hunter Biden's gun trial. The president's son is accused of illegally purchasing a gun at a time when he was using drugs. Hunter Biden's defense team argued he was in recovery and not a drug user at the time. If convicted, he could face up to 25 years in prison, though would likely receive a much lighter sentence. And the Reverend James Lawson has died at the age of 95. Lawson was a godfather of the civil rights movement, whom Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. once called the leading theorist and strategist of nonviolence in the world. During the Korean War in the 50s, James Lawson was imprisoned for refusing to be drafted into the U.S. Army. He was later expelled from Vanderbilt University Divinity School for helping to organize lunch counter sit-in protests against segregation. As a missionary in India, Lawson studied Mahatma Gandhi's principles of nonviolence. He would go on to teach nonviolent civil disobedience tactics to rank-and-file activists in the civil rights movement. In 2020, Reverend Lawson was among speakers at the funeral of Congressmember John Lewis at the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta.
We will not be quiet. As long as our nation continues to be the most violent culture in the history of humankind, we will not be quiet. As long as our economy is shaped not by freedom, but by plantation capitalism that continues to cause domination and control rather than access and liberty and equality for all.
To see our interview with Reverend James Lawson, you can go to democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
In Europe, residents of 27 countries went to the polls this weekend for the European Union's parliamentary elections. With nearly 400 million eligible voters, the EU elections are among the world's biggest democratic polls, which are held every 5 years. This year's results ended in a strong showing for the far right across much of the European Union, while many liberals and green parties stumbled. Most of the far-right gains were concentrated in countries that elect large number of seats to the EU Parliament, France, Italy, and Germany. Incoming lawmakers can veto and shape laws, though they cannot introduce them. They also set the EU's budget and approve the selection of the European Commission president, a powerful role currently held by Ursula von der Leyen of the center-right European People's Party. And despite the far-right surge across much of the EU, the European People's Party was the biggest single winner on Sunday, remaining the strongest group in the European Parliament. On Monday, EU chief Ursula von der Leyen spoke in Berlin about the vote.
This election on European soil had two basic messages. Firstly, there is still a majority in favor of a strong Europe in the center of the political spectrum. In other words, the center has held. But it is also true that the extremes on the left and on the right have gained support. And that is why this result is also associated with a great responsibility for the parties in the center.
The election results triggered a political earthquake in France, where Marine Le Pen's far-right National Rally Party won 30% of the vote, more than double President Emmanuel Macron's Renaissance Party. In a surprise move, President Macron responded by dissolving the French Parliament and calling for snap legislative elections in France, which will be held in 3 weeks. In Belgium, the prime minister resigned after his party suffered heavy losses. In Germany, Chancellor Olaf Scholz's Social Democratic Party suffered a crushing defeat, coming in third behind the far-right Alternative for Germany, which scored its best results in history with 16% of the vote. In Italy, Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni's far-right Brothers of Italy party surged to firstly 30% of the vote. In Austria, the far-right Freedom Party was also forecast to finish first. For more, we go to London to speak with Mehreen Khan. She's the economics editor at The Times in London and a former Brussels and EU correspondent for The Financial Times. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Mehreen. It's great to have you with us. Can you just start off with the overall trend in Europe and then specifically talk about what's happened in France?
Sure. Thank you so much for having me on the show, Amy. I'm a big fan. So as you've already mentioned, there have been two major consequences from these elections. One is a drift towards the far right in the composition of the European Parliament, and then this very unexpected political and potentially constitutional crisis in France. To start off with the sort of European landscape, I think it's worth stressing to the listeners and to the audience that having huge surges of one party is quite difficult in the European Parliament because you have 27 elections, which are often run on domestic agendas in 27 different countries, which are all at different points in their political cycle. But what we can say is that the two biggest member states of the European Union, in France and Germany, there has been a clear shift towards the right, and that's the far right in terms of the AfD, a party which used to be based around Eurosceptic and anti-Euro ideals, but has moved definitively towards anti-migration, anti-Islam, sort of classic populist nativist culture wars in Germany. And similarly, the same has happened among Marine Le Pen with her Front National Party, now known as a Rassemblement National. So they've had a rebranding in recent years to make them seem, I think, a bit more political palatable to French voters. I think on the European scale, immediately nothing, because it's very hard in aggregate to get huge swings towards one part of the political spectrum. There is a sort of received wisdom that the centre has held, and that's because the three main parties who made the coalition that supported Ursula von der Leyen in 2019 are still likely to have a majority. But I think looking at the aggregate actually ignores what's going on at a slightly deeper level, and I think more substantive level, where the centre-right parties, the Christian Democrat parties of Europe, led by the likes of the CDU in Germany, have definitely moved towards the space that was occupied by the far right. There's been a clear rightward drift on climate policy, so a backlash against green activism, a clear move towards stronger anti-immigration policies, and a rhetoric around culture wars, around Christianity, around Israel, around foreign policy, the role of European civilization, which means that these formerly centre-right parties are now definitely occupying territory that we used to call that of the far right. So in that sense, is the incremental shift of the European Parliament towards the right is not just because of the insurgent far right, but also because of the mainstream parties. And then if we move on to France, I think this is the most unexpected political earthquake to have come from any European elections to have ever held since 1979, which is that they've basically created a domestic political crisis in one of European Union's most important countries, France. And Emmanuel Macron looked at the results and decided that he wanted to confront the far right in quite a binary way, very little time to prepare, to mobilise or to organise. And his bet seems to be that if French voters are given a choice, a very clear choice between his party and Marine Le Pen's far right, that they will choose him. And even if they don't, the possibility of having a far-right prime minister for the next couple of years before the more important presidential election in 2027, he thinks that they will do such a bad job in office that it will become clear to French voters by 2027 that this is a party that is not fit for governance, and this is a party of incompetent, unprofessional cadres, and they're not ready to run France and therefore consolidate his own power base.
And Mehreen Khan, I wanted to ask you, in terms of the vote, the rise especially of the far right parties, to what degree the battle over immigration and migrants from the global south, very much like the United States, where immigration has become a huge issue in the current presidential race, to what degree do you see the potential for these extreme right parties to continue to grow as they try to mobilize their populations against the migrants coming in?
Well, I think there is a clear parallel with the United States, and I would say that parallel is that rather than being a contested area, migration is an area which there is huge amounts of consensus from the left, the right, and the far right that Europe is a continent that is closed, whose borders are closed. I think the push towards having anti-immigration policies, so tough immigration policies that stop people, as you've already mentioned, from the global south coming in, that this also includes laws around refugees and asylum seekers. The European Union has probably decided since 2015 that it is a continent that does not want these people in its country. So in that sense, the far right has won that argument because it's become a mainstream consensus. I think the areas where the far right has shown a bit more political innovation is moving on to territories like climate change, so creating a culture war around the green transition, saying that this is expensive for ordinary people, that you know, even bordering sometimes on climate denialism. And again, if we think about the United States, there's another parallel, and I think the far-right parties in Europe really do take a lot of cues from Donald Trump's Republican Party, and they've definitely moved into more of the social sphere. So speaking about Europe in civilizational terms, in racial terms, and in religious terms. And this is where I think the far-right probably is finding more appeal among voters, a kind of emotional and identitarian appeal, which does include migration, but isn't definitely broadening out from just being a one-issue subject for the far right. They seem to be a movement, at least, that wants to encompass all areas of policy, from foreign policy, economic policy, and also social and cultural policy.
And how do you assess the failures of the left parties in Europe to gain ground? I mean, there were some which did, but for the most part, they did not.
It's difficult to assess it on an aggregate level, but if we think about some small pockets, so there have been surprise successes in the Netherlands, where the Greens and the Socials and the Social Democrats, the traditional left, actually teamed up and they did well. They became the first party in the Netherlands, second to the far-right party of Geert Wilders. But generally, the left has struggled to find a message, and in particular, an economic message for populations in Europe that have basically seen stagnant wage growth, a cost of living crisis, very high energy prices. And I think crucially, they've also failed to get that sort of emotional appeal, something that the far right seem to do far better, creating narratives around identity, about around people's place in their member states, in their countries, their relationships to their governments and to each other. It's worth noting that if the UK had been a member state in the European Union, this is the first time that Britain was not participating in a European election, the left would have done pretty well, because Labour probably would have had a stonking huge vote swing in their favour. And then we would probably be talking about a Social Democrat grouping in the European Parliament that was close to the biggest, the EPP. So there are lots of variables involved. But I think you're right that generally the left has failed to beat the far right because they've been outflanked on so many areas, including traditional strengths, which they would have seen, like creating social and economic justice and providing a sense of inclusivity and diversity. These messages have either not been pushed far enough in countries like France, or have been seen to be, you know, too beyond the pale for, I think, a population in many Western European countries where there is just a very general and long-term trend towards the right.
Marie-Jeanne, for people, especially in the United States, who may not really understand the way Europe works with the European Parliament, if you can explain its role, its power, how significant it is, and also back in France, who Marine Le Pen is.
Sure. The European Parliament is one of the three major bodies of the European Union. Its executive is called the European Commission. Then there is a collection of the member states, so the heads of all of the 27 governments, known as the European Council. And then there is the European Parliament, which is supposed to be the democratic hub of the European Union. They have the ability to veto legislation, which is proposed by the European Commission. They also negotiate on legislation. Generally, the European Parliament has been held together by a grand coalition, a coalition between the centre-left and the centre-right. That has persisted. It persisted all the way through the parliament until 2019, when liberals had to be brought in to support the coalition. We think the liberals and the Greens are also going to be brought in to support a coalition behind the president of the European Commission. And it's very important for her. We think it's going to be Ursula von der Leyen again to have this support, because it means that having a majority means that she can pass proposed legislation through the parliament, even after, you know, there have been tweaks and made. The European Parliament, however, is seen to be probably the weakest of those three institutions that I've already mentioned. That's because they're usually divided. It's quite difficult to mobilize the European Parliament as a singular force, because it's becoming much more fractured. And we know that now, because we have a far left, and increasingly large far right who will try and disrupt the process of legislation in the European Union. And if we're thinking about France, for your listeners in the US, I'm trying to think of a parallel to Marine Le Pen in the US. I don't think there is a clear one, but she has been the face, and I think the acceptable face, of the far right in France for about 10 years. She took over a party called the Front National from her father, which when he was in charge, Jean-Marie Le Pen, it was a far more anti-Semitic, far more overtly racist party. It's been the job of Marine Le Pen to create a softer image around the Front National. However, they're still considered to be the far right, despite dropping, I think, some of the anti-Semitism. They've definitely been moving into areas like Islamophobia. They are an incredibly anti-Muslim party. They speak, and Marine Le Pen has said that the sight of Muslims praying on the streets was the equivalent to the Nazi occupation of France in the 1930s. This is still a party that is considered to be beyond the pale, or had been considered to be beyond the pale by mainstream parties. But as we're probably going to see in the next 3 weeks, there is now a chance for the first time in French history that the parliament and the prime minister will be from the far-right party. And this is a prelude to the potential of having a far-right French president in 2027.
Finally, we just have 30 seconds, Mehreen. The role of Israel's war on Gaza in these various elections.
The European Union countries are usually split on the issue of Israel, and often that's not a partisan thing. It's about historical ties towards Palestine. One thing that I will note is, we don't have too much time, is that before these elections, there was a lot of talk and discourse around Brussels that Vladimir Putin would be very happy if there was a far-right insurgency in Europe. We haven't heard too much from Putin, but what we have heard is that the Israeli government, led by Benjamin Netanyahu, has already expressed that they are very happy with this outcome of a far-right insurgency because they think this will protect Israel from criticism among European Union member states. And I think that is a pretty decent bet on his part. I think that is true. I think criticism of Israel will become much more difficult in the European Union because far-right parties are very closely aligned to what they think of their spiritual partner in Israel, and particularly the figure of Benjamin Netanyahu.
Mehreen Khan, we want to thank you so much for being with us now. Economics editor at the Times of London, former Brussels and EU correspondent for the Financial Times. Next up, we speak to Dr. James Smith. He's in Istanbul today. He's an emergency medical doctor who just left Gaza after 2 months. Back in 20 seconds.
Thank you. Cheers.
Sound by the French duo Justice. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. In Gaza, the healthcare system's barely functioning 8 months into Israel's devastating assault. In a statement Monday, Gaza's health ministry warned the few remaining hospitals still partially functioning could completely shut down if diesel generators needed for electricity are not replaced or maintained soon. The ministry said it expected a number of generators at hospitals to fail because Israel's preventing the entry of necessary spare parts. Health facilities that supply things like oxygen and refrigeration for medicine are facing a complete shutdown, which the health ministry said in a statement, quote, means certain death for the sick and injured and the complete end of health services, end quote. In addition to severe shortages of electricity, medical supplies and equipment as a result of the Israeli blockade, Gaza's hospitals have been hit by Israeli airstrikes repeatedly over the last 8 months. The World Health Organization said this week, since October 7th, there have been more than 460 Israeli attacks on Gaza's healthcare system, affecting over 100 health facilities. More than 37,000 Palestinians have been killed in Israel's war on Gaza, with thousands more missing under the rubble and presumed dead. A staggering 85,000 people have been wounded. For more, we're joined by Dr. James Smith, emergency medical doctor just back from Gaza, spent nearly 2 months there treating patients at trauma stabilization points in Al-Mawasi and Rafah. Also worked in the emergency rooms of Al-Aqsa Hospital in Deir al-Balah and Al-Auda Hospital in Nusayrat. He left Gaza Friday. He joins us today. We welcome you to Democracy Now! If you can start off, Dr.